Welcome everyone to this event organized by Global Visions, in which we discuss the challenges, opportunities and future visions related to a global carbon tax. My name is Max Talberi and I'm the founder and chairperson of the Global Visions Association. We act as a platform for the discussion on how the state of the world can be improved, especially from the point of view of global justice and equality, and we also highlight different societal visions regarding all of this. This panel discussion is being filmed and will be made available on our website for those who wish to revisit the discussion or share it with others. And we will follow this event up with our annual State of the World event, which will be held also here in Musiktalo on the 3rd of December. Yes, but for this event we have with us Professor Janne Hukkinen, who is a professor of environmental policy at the University of Helsinki, specializing in the socio-cognitive aspects of sustainability and environmental risk governance. Professor Heikki Patomäki, who is a professor of world politics and global political economy at the University of Helsinki. His research interests include philosophy, methodology of social sciences, economic theory, global political economy, big history, future studies, and global justice and democracy. And Juha Turkki, who is Development Director for Systemic Climate Solutions at the Climate Leadership Coalition, CLC, Europe's largest non-profit climate business network. At CLC, Turkey focuses on advancing carbon removal strategies, international climate cooperation, and policies that accelerate the transition to climate neutrality. And Dr. Ville Seppälä, who currently works at the National Audit Office of Finland, auditing the knowledge base of climate policy and previously created visual climate analytics for the European Parliamentary Research Service. He recently also produced a global carbon price and dividend simulator with support from the Kone Foundation.
Welcome everyone on my behalf as well. I'm Astrid Aminoff, the project planner at Global Visions, and I will be the moderator for this section of the event. But as we don't have so much time, I think we'll get right into the discussion. So thank you everyone for being here tonight. I think we'll begin with a question for Heikki, and you can all comment freely once he has finished. But to start, could you explain what a global carbon tax is, how it differs from other forms of global carbon pricing, such as emissions trading, and how it might operate in practice at the international level?
Even though this is a very large question, I need to go back and provide some background for my answer. The first thing is that if you look at the figures, global warming, I mean, what's happening in the world at the moment, and 2024 was the first year when we exceeded the 1.5 Celsius degrees global warming compared to the pre-industrial levels. And the World Meteorological Organization says that the 25 this year, it is about 90% likelihood that the we will exceed 1.5 Celsius degree again. And the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, uses moving averages in estimating or assessing how much global warming there has been. So they actually use 20-year average, which I think might be misleading to the extent that there's an acceleration in global warming going on. And if we simply use the actual temperature figures rather than the these average 20-year averages, and estimate what has happened during the past 15 or 20 years, we are very likely to already exceed 2 Celsius degrees in the 2040s and 3 Celsius degrees in the 2060s. So the situation is actually quite worrying. And the gravity of the situation calls for new kinds of solutions. And I think a carbon tax, a global carbon tax for that matter, is such a solution. Let's have a look at the other figures as well. The global emissions, I mean, let me start taking a step backwards once again. There have been many measures and many agreements taken to counter the trend and tendencies toward global warming. However, the main way of responding, or the most important way of trying to do something to tackle the problem, has been the establishment of emission trading systems, which is a market-based solution. And the idea is that you give carbon a price, and thereby you reduce the consumption of carbon, whether in production processes or in ordinary consumption of the consumers or whatever. The effects have been relatively meager. In 2024, global emissions were higher than ever before. So even though there have been many measures taken, there are now something like 30, 40 different emission trading systems in the world. The revenues for the auctions and other measures is about $100 billion dollars or euros per year. So it seems that, I mean, there have been many successful attempts to tackle the problem. But in fact, the emissions are higher than ever. And further problem is also that the effect of these emissions is delayed. So it will take from 5 to 30 years for the current emissions to have a full effect on global climate. So no matter what we do now, the fact that in 2024 the emissions were higher than ever means that the global warming will continue unabated for the next 30 years at least. And the so some drastic measures are actually needed. And it seems that these emission trading systems are clearly not enough. In fact, there's another way of thinking about carbon pricing, and that's a tax. But there are two ways of thinking about the tax itself. One is the typical neoclassical economics way of thinking about the tax, which is that the you try to internalize the externalities. In other words, the when you, in production processes, for instance, you emit carbon to the atmosphere, that's considered to be an externality, and because that doesn't actually imply any costs to the producers. The idea is that by setting a tax, you can actually give a price to those emissions, to that carbon. And so you internalize the externalities. That's one way of thinking about it. I think a more radical and far-reaching way of thinking about this is to think about the market disruptive tax. So the point is not to actually simply internalize the externalities, but rather to actually introduce a tax that goes beyond the optimization in this sense. The idea is actually to curb these markets to the extent possible, and then also to use the revenues for the green transition on the one hand, but also for the mitigating the effects of global warming that are inevitable anyway. I'm not even sure whether this is enough, but I mean, at least it would be a good starting point. The other thing is also that the currently existing emission trading systems are mostly either national or regional, so they don't cover the entire world. And there are some systems, and including also the Article 6 of Paris Agreement-based systems, where the idea is to have some trade or emissions trade internationally between countries. And so that's another possibility as well. But there's no global system in place. And this is what we would need as well. It is very difficult to organize a global system, particularly if the assumption is that in these negotiations leading to such a system, there has to be some kind of a consensus among 196 states. That is an impossible thing to achieve. But there's another way forward, and I stop here. It is that the coalition of the willing, a grouping of countries, takes the initiative, establishes a global system, including also taxing the borders toward the outsiders, and then encourages, by all means possible, to the others to join the system as soon as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Heikki. Who would like to comment? Mille?
Yeah. About the ETS or emission trading systems, as you said, like there has been a lot of these systems, and I think it's maybe a little bit wrong to pit these against each other, because they are very similar. Both are like forms of carbon pricing that are equally efficient, in my view. Like, it's just like in emission trading, you set the emission cap, and then the price follows it. But on the tax, it's the other way around, that you set the tax, and then the emissions follow, and if you have a these are like equally efficient. You just there's a like the uncertainty is a different place, but like I think we might as well have like a global emission trading system, or maybe it would be like bureaucratically a little bit more difficult, but yeah, I wouldn't like consider this like it's kind of like a I think these are like equally good solutions for carbon pricing, which is the important thing that we should be pushing forward.
May I respond very quickly?
You may respond, and then Juha can comment after.
Yeah. I think this is the standard here, classical view. Yeah. Yes, and I can see the point, but there are actually major qualitative differences between the tax and the trading emission system. One is that the tax is much less bureaucratic than the trading emission system. It's also much less vulnerable to all kinds of problems that the emission trading systems typically encounter. Those include the volatility of the price, and there's a tendency toward exceeding amount of permits to be there in the marketplace. And then you need further systems like this market compensating mechanisms and such like. So it becomes an extremely complicated system, whereas the carbon tax system is much simpler. And the further thing is also that there's a difference between tax and the trading in terms of moral orientation. This is more sociological point and something that can be said from the point of view of economics. The point is that taxes always punishes the harmful behavior. But in the trading emission trading schemes, you can actually also make money. And there are speculative aspects to those markets as well, namely that you can trade derivatives and things like that. So financialization is very much part of that system as well. And it's even vulnerable to corruption as well. Whereas carbon tax is simpler, and it gives the right kinds of ideas about what's the right thing to do.
Okay, you are.
Okay. I agree with you. We have a couple of decades' time to go to net zero on global level. And there we have to get a view how our emissions are evolving, how they are developing during the time. And for that, I think the emission trading scheme with the cap, it gives certainty about the emission development, which is, I think, the main point. Of course, there is a lot of bureaucracy, but with tax-based scheme, as you said, we are not we cannot be sure about the emission level, where we are heading. And then the most important thing is that the price, whether it's tax or ETS price, is effective enough. And that's not the case, as you said, in many of those ETS schemes. But on tax-based scheme, we should have also effective price. And then it's a question whether we have such politicians who are willing to set high enough tax. Mm. We have to get different technologies which have quite high abatement cost, so quite high marginal cost, and thus they need a high price for carbon. Mm. And if you think about the politicians, I'm not sure whether there is certainty that there is, they are courage enough to do that. Of course, that's also the case with the EU ETS. But if you have locked, in a way, the emission cap, there is this longer term certainty, and that is also what we need when we think about the different technologies. Let's think about, for example, low carbon steel. Lifetime is 20 to 40 years. So there has to be predictability Otherwise, those investors, they will not invest in those technologies. And for me, ETS, especially how it's done in Europe, gives more predictability than tax-based scheme.
Okay. I think that you've partly already answered the question, but the next question is for Juha, and others can, of course, comment.
Mm. I thought that Janne would be next, but anyway. So
I was going to, I mean, I can comment, but I think I'm going to comment on this because I know that you're going to ask me about some of the political barriers to implementing these, so I think I'm going to cover these.
Would you still like me to ask you the second question, Juha, or should we move on to Janne's question?
Let me just add one point, because this is quite important as well. I totally agree that there's a political problem. Mm. It has to do with power relations, also with the power of the corporations. I mean, there's a lot of lobbying going on and so on. But I mean, this is a problem both in the emissions trading system and tax system. It doesn't matter which one it is. I mean, we have the same problem with power and politics. Mm. The thing is, though, that there can be a lot of predictability with the tax as well. I mean, independently of the business cycle or any other changes in the markets or production levels and so on. For instance, when there was the euro crisis, I mean, there was a total stop in emission trading in some systems at least. Because there were so many permits available. And this doesn't happen with the tax. I mean, in that sense, it's also more predictable. I mean, it depends on the aspect that you're focusing on.
I answer?
Yes, yeah.
I agree. I was following the emission trading, or actually I have been working with emission trading somehow since 2005, since the beginning, its beginning. And we know that the price, it has crashed several times, and I think it was 2014 or something like that. The price was about 3 euros per ton, and that's not enough for that makes nothing. But after that, there was a surplus of allowances which pushed the price down, and after that, this market stability reserve, which you mentioned, it was established, and so it takes out the surplus of allowances from the market, and after that the price has increased to somewhat effective level. Those were the mistakes the politicians which were made in the beginning, and I think what we can learn from that is that this kind of additional mechanism is needed. But with that kind of mechanism, I think it works. And may I continue?
Yes, you may.
Okay. Do you want to present the question?
Well, the second question for you, which was that you've already discussed the main problems with carbon tax models, and then... Yeah. What is your perspective on a global carbon tax compared with these regional or global emission trading systems?
I go to regional and global.
Okay.
So whether that's DAX or ETS, or whether the scheme would be based on tax or ETS, I think it's more important that it's suitable for those regional economies which are different in Nordics, in Europe, in Asia, in Africa, so that each of them have a different effective price. So in that sense, I think this kind of regional schemes would be more efficient than just to go on global level. There are so many, so much differences between the societies, different energy systems, different industrial systems, and in order to incentivize the technologies and solutions needed,
So do you argue that there could be a benefit for having like different prices across different regions?
Yeah. Well, let me say two things. One is that the in the proposals I've been making about for a global greenhouse gas tax, the idea is not to simply replace the existing ETS systems with a global tax, but I mean at least for the foreseeable time, they would be complementary systems because I mean there would be no point in simply abolishing the already existing system, but to add something on top of that because I mean the problem is is severe. And the, even though I prefer taxes to trading, it doesn't mean that the trading systems are not doing anything useful. The second thing is that the in the more reasonable the ways or designs for global greenhouse gas tax or carbon tax, the tax level wouldn't be the same in different parts of the world. I mean, this concerns tax justice on the one hand, but it is also a way of addressing some of these very contentious issues that have been preventing any agreement on a global scale so far. So it is quite important that the poorer countries, I mean, the that their level of taxation is much lower than the in the richer countries. And and then there's a question about also redistributing some of them. If we have a global fund and global mechanisms for redistribution, I mean, that could also be a way of compensating for some of the effects.
Yes, you are. You may continue.
Okay. yes, I agree. There is no one silver bullet, as we can say. Yeah, there are some sectors which in which there is no that many options to lower emissions, and there this kind of tax or whatever, perhaps the ETS is not the best solution. So combination of different systems, I think it might be reasonable, but the regional characteristics, I think they should be taken into account.
And given also the gravity of situation, we need to do much as we can.
Yeah. So we have to be so efficient as we can.
Okay, Ville, do you have a comment?
Yeah. I think you're both like supporting this like regional. I'm not sure about you, but like this regional differences in prices and. But I mentioned kind of like another option for this is just kind of like redistributing these like revenues, which would kind of like because it would help like the poorest regions to face the higher prices because the richer regions they produce more emissions, so they in net the poorer regions would win. So I would prefer this kind of system. And I consider like this kind of especially if you have like very different levels of carbon pricing, like are we gonna like have these same problems that we currently have? For example, in EU, we are very concerned that there's gonna be like carbon leakage. So our industries are gonna move to some other countries because like if they have like no carbon pricing or if they have a very low carbon price, so. That would keep us from increasing our prices. So at least the price parity should be very like quite narrow, or like the difference should be quite narrow. I'm not sure. Like, are you how concerned you are about this?
No, this is a really important point. I agree entirely that the fact that production very easily can be moved to other places. I mean, has been a problem. That's the reason why we need these border mechanisms as well. So when we take all things into consideration, we have to make compromises between different aims. And so there can be differences in tax levels, but they can't be too big, because otherwise there is this problem. But on the other hand, we can also have compensatory mechanisms on a global scale. Yeah. So public investments to the allocated to particular regions or places or countries. And then there's also the problem that many of those countries that are going to suffer particularly badly from global warming or heating, are in the global south, and very often they have done nothing with the problem itself. They have not contributed to the problem. And so it is just only fair that the global mechanism exists to not only to compensate for these effects, but also to mitigate some of the worst problems, let's say in the Horn of Africa, for instance, or some other places as well. And that's another reason why we need a global fund, a global mechanism to compensate for that. Finally, this redistributional or distributional aspects are extremely important, but they also concern ordinary citizens as well. I mean, carbon taxes are regressive taxes. I mean, like any consumption taxes or something like. So the typically, I think, in order to counter that regressive effect in terms of income distribution, you need to allocate at least one third, if not half, of all the revenues to either social welfare mechanisms or simply redistribute the money back to the citizen, citizens one way or the other. And otherwise, the tax would be extremely unpopular as well, particularly in the global south.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
I could add to this point that it's in a way linked to this so-called ecological tax reform, which has the logic of sort of reducing income taxation while you increase environmental taxes. And I think there's sort of that's another way of sort of dealing with the inequalities resulting from a new kind of taxation system.
Okay, thank you. Well, the next question is for Janne. So from the perspective of environmental politics, what are the greatest political, legal, and public acceptance barriers to implementing a global carbon tax? And what strategies or governance approaches could help overcome them?
I guess politically, one of the classical, and you have talked about it in this discussion already, is sort of this the notion that politicians in general don't like trying to sell taxes to the voters, because they assume that voters don't like taxes. And I would say that this is actually we should take seriously this notion of assumption that politicians assume this is the case, but it's not necessarily always the case. Historically, this reluctance has resulted. I mean, we have carbon taxes, national carbon taxes. This country has carbon taxes, but they've historically been so low, precisely because the taxes are unpopular, that they don't really have any influence in the behavior of individuals. So, in a sense, that's kind of the flip side of this difficulty of selling it. Another one is sort of this notion that taxes have, to my understanding, always been considered national interests. It's sovereign nation states have the right to tax. If you extend it to the global level, it immediately implies both political issues, political difficulties in the implementation, and probably also legal issues at the national level. There needs to be legal adjustments and changes to enable global level taxation. So that I think is key. There's an interesting thing in this in general too. If you want to do, in a sense, try to ease the selling of environmental taxes, carbon taxes, it's sort of this idea of funnel, which the tax designers don't like. I mean, tax designers fundamentally like tax, what they call tax neutrality. In other words, you collect, the crown collects the taxes and uses them as politicians decide to use them. Whereas for an individual taxpayer, and I think this relates also to global carbon taxes, an individual taxpayer would like to know that what was charged on the basis of their environmental harm is funneled to improve the environmental matters. it is psychological. It's in the study. It's psychologically more appealing if you know where the money goes, rather than it go than going to the large chests of of the crown, who then decides whatever. So in a sense, there's an interesting thing here, and I think it relates sort of to this equality notions and redistributions, is to somehow also take into consideration these, the, in a sense, how to sell taxes.
Which is a slightly paradoxical
notion. It's a paradoxical notion, which takes me to another issue in environmental policy. One of the latest sort of what has been sold as a popular environmental policy instrument is called nudging, where you sort of utilize subtle mechanisms to influence an individual's psychology and behavior, and so that they imperceptibly, sometimes unknown to themselves, change their behavior to something that the, in this case, the tax authorities would want them to do, or the product sale. It's kind of like marketing. But I mean, I don't consider nudging a policy instrument, but I do think that it's an interesting mechanism specifically for increasing the attractiveness of otherwise unpalatable environmental policy instruments, such as taxation. And I think there's a lot of work, the positive work, that could be done in this way of really getting good minds to consider how to make taxation and all kinds of environmental policy instruments more palatable to the general public and to politicians.
Thank you. Man.
Yeah, I would like to go back to this issue of state sovereignty and difficulty of establishing anything like a global tax. We need to remember, though, that the modern taxation systems are pretty recent. I mean, they haven't existed for a long while. The first ever income tax was introduced by Britain during the Napoleonic Wars, and they abolished it for many years, many decades, actually. And the income taxes started to be common, or become common, only in the late 19th century in Europe at first. And the and that, of course, required a particular understanding of incomes and markets and many other things as well, but it also requires certain bureaucratic ideas and notions, plus a political movement that wanted to protect society from the market, if you like, to use Karl Polanyi's expression. And the and that became much more prevalent after the First World War. That also led to the first commercialization of state sovereignty and taxation, namely the emergence of tax havens. And that already happened during the interwar era. And there were many struggles over that. But the catastrophes of the 1930s and 40s, basically, particularly the Second World War, closed down all the tax havens. They only were re-established within the remnants of the British Empire in the early 1960s. And they gradually started to grow and become more important. But this tells something about the history of tax. I mean, how recent these things on the one hand are, and how global, I mean, these developments have been. I mean, they have occurred almost simultaneously across the board in different countries. And the the counterpart has always been that some places have decided to exploit the tax differences by appealing some actors to relocate their activities or residence or whatever to their jurisdiction, and to avoid taxes, basically. And this is where we are at the moment. And there has been like 50, 60 years of various proposals for global taxes. We are still in a situation where even the European Union doesn't have a right to tax. Mm-hmm. The European emission trading system, for instance, is still based on the idea that the states are actually auctioning these permits, and they also keep all the revenues as well, I mean, 90% of it anyway. Yeah. And it's not part of the EU budget or anything like that, so even the EU doesn't have a right to tax. Mm-hmm. And so this is a radical the proposal on the one hand, but on the other hand, I think it's only a matter of time, given all these considerations, how things are evolving, how we have a truly interconnected world economy, and its dynamics is playing a major role everywhere on the planet. And we have these problems like global warming, etc. It's only a matter of time when we will have global taxes. And it might well happen that we will have global taxes before we have European taxes, for that matter.
Yeah, I think this is like a very important point here. And like, and I think this kind of like transition phase in itself is like, it is the barrier. It's like, if we magically tomorrow had this system of global carbon tax, I think like most of the world, like almost everyone would be happy, but it's so hard to get there. And I think that's kind of the issue, like how the painful transition there. And like, I think what EU is like, with the carbon border adjustment mechanism, we are trying to like push the rest of the world to that direction, because in the system, in this mechanism, so what it does, it's basically a tariff for imports that are coming from other countries, like placing their carbon price on that way. But if the country where we are importing from, if they have the similar level of carbon pricing as EU, then they don't have to pay the tariff. So this is basically, and it kind of like benefits the other country, because then they get to keep the money, they get to like get the result of the carbon pricing instead of the EU through the import. So I think this is like a good system, but it's just like and I think there have been like some kind of like indications that this has might have like, I don't know if you have like other examples, but I think like Turkey is implementing ETS maybe, and like and it's gonna be like linked to the EU like carbon border adjustment mechanism, and through that to the EU ETS pricing. And and Malaysia is implementing probably like, I checked this in some World Bank report, that they might have like a carbon tax that will be like, this CBAM adjustment. And China is like expanding its EDS to sectors that are gonna like import, that have these like imports. So it is working at least to some extent, but of course I think the very big problem there is that it is at least at the moment, it's like concerning like only like these like very like crude imports, like steel, like blocks. It doesn't concern cars, it concerns like steel bars. So it's kind of like it's very like and that's like, that can be bad for our industry, because so there's like so yeah, I'm not sure if like if like this kind of like maybe another option to do this is this Nobel laureate William Nordhaus. He has this climate club idea where it is like just a simple tariff. It's not like even trying to estimate the carbon contents of the imports, but it could be like easier to implement, because I think now the CBAM, it's starting like 2027. Now it's just been like implemented, like rolled out at the moment, but it has this like, maybe I'm not sure if it's like how bright it is looking at the moment, but at least like EU is trying this, and at least to some extent it's working. But I'm not sure like how optimistic you are about this EU's project of, and how it should be improved.
I'm not familiar with it, so I won't respond to that. But what I do think is, one of the points that you made is and relating to this Nordhaus idea is, I think it's really, I see some developments where sort of the more natural scientist-oriented researchers somehow link the success or the implementation of any kind of carbon regulation to very precise measurements, that you absolutely must have very precise measurements.
Yeah.
I beg to disagree. the need for very precise, because I think agreements are institutions and laws are, you know, decided upon. Sometimes they're not exactly right, and then they will be revised. So given the rush that we have with climate change, we ought to be, you know, implementing whatever agreements are roughly to the right direction, then follow up, let the scientists develop their carbon measurements and all that stuff, and that will feed into the redesign of the institution. But the point is to get the rules in place as soon as possible.
Did you have something, Juha?
Yeah, please.
okay, I come to this carbon border, or I continue this. yeah, there is currently Turkey is planning ETS, and that's for some degree as a result of EU ETS. Also, India is considering EU ETS, but what comes to measurement? Measurement. It's currently it's a problem, because it causes, of course, bureaucracy. It causes additional work, and those non-EU countries can now assess the carbon content, and they are not willing that much to do that. So of course there are problems. The carbon border adjustment mechanism. it starts from the not the folly EU ETS price. It's increasing by 2035 or mid 2030 into folly, to be folly included.
About the Nordhaus point and what Janne said, I mean, I think we all are in agreement that the measurements are a problem. Causes a lot of work and bureaucracy and so on. But it's also, I mean, additional point is that simplicity is a virtue. A taxation system shouldn't be too complicated. And the simple rules are always better. And the if they are possible. So I would prefer to use only like a few categories, and that's all. I mean, the certain level of tariffs or levies based on certain things, and then there can be contestations over whether this or that belongs to that category or some other category. But I mean, that would be simple, three or four different categories only.
And I think, like, especially because, like, with EU and ETS, like, we have like an army of bureaucrats that can go to these plants in EU and check that, okay, are you reporting correctly and stuff like that. But we cannot go to China, or I'm not sure, like, at least. Or you can, but like it's a lot harder, and kind of like, and it's better than just like to use this kind of like rough estimates. But if we had this global tax, then of course we would have like a global army of bureaucrats that can do this supervision. Like it would be part of the deal that you could have international like checks, or so it wouldn't. So I think it would be a good part of this kind of like system, that it wouldn't be just, because then it would like stifle these threats of corruption from some governments.
Yeah. That's a good point, important point. Many international organizations are behaving like that already. I mean, they're monitoring developments in different parts of the world, so they apply surveillance. I mean, they functional, very specific functional areas. Think about the International Atomic Energy Agency, for instance. So that monitors the use of nuclear power, basically. And it's very technical. I mean, the budget is not large. I mean, if we had a global carbon tax, the revenues could be in the order of 300, 400, even 500 billion a year. Whereas the auction revenues at the moment, I mean, counting globally, are less than 100 billion.
we have to take into account that the price is not effective if you talk about these 28% of coverage of or these ETS systems. I don't say that the price is effective. So it's too low in most of these schemes, and then we cannot compare.
But the revenues only come from auctioning these permits, but then the trading itself doesn't yield any revenues.
Of course.
But whereas taxes are always bringing income to the tax audit.
But like the permits, they permit trading, it does create revenue the same as various taxes, right? Because you put the permits to sale, so that's how you get the.
They can be traded after that.
Yeah, sure, but I don't think it's.
But the revenue comes, so there within the EU, member states have certain amount of of carbon allowances. And they sell them, or auction them to the market, and they get the revenue.
Yeah, yeah. And what happens in the market, it doesn't matter to revenues.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
So it's basically it's like tax.
Yeah, I think. Yeah,
yeah, but one off tax.
I mean, yeah, yeah. Paid
on bonus, but I mean, if you consume carbon, then you pay all the time. I mean, there is no stop to it, and there is also no bureaucratic struggle over how to define the level of taxation. The cap and trade system is very vulnerable to those kinds of struggles within these organizations. I mean, who is going to define who has the right to do exactly what, and what areas are important, and where do you actually have auctions? I mean, in the European Union, there have been many areas or sectors where they were given these permits for free.
Yeah.
They are now already using that, but still, this has been one of the problems as well. But that's only kind of a radical example of how these bureaucratic categorizations of different sectors and different whatever needs there might be, I mean, affect the how the system works.
But the allowances were given for free to avoid the competitiveness loss, and that's also
a global problem.
Yeah. But that would be also the problem with tax, with high enough tax, with an effective tax level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you should somehow consider
why
this.
We need the global system.
Mm. Yeah. That's true. Yeah, we should have a common rules. Yeah.
Did you want to say something, Janne?
No. I guess this proves the point that there's always politics involved. There's always, you know, regardless of, yes, there's always this with the emission trading system. You have this, you know, ideally, economists say the initial allowances should be auctioned off. They were not, because there's strong lobbying to say that no, we want them free. but with the taxes, the same thing. That, you know, the largest corporations in this country, their energy taxation is much lower than mine is. So,
yeah.
But you're not against international competing against international companies. So you don't have a carbon leakage problem. So, but these companies
true.
Might have.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Okay. Seeing as we're already discussing it, then let's now look more closely on the concept of global carbon pricing. So Ville has recently worked on a simulation tool for global carbon pricing and a global carbon dividend. Mm-hmm. So what can these simulations tell us about how a global carbon tax might function in reality, for example, in terms of economic impacts and effectiveness in reducing emissions?
Yeah, let's say that, like, I'm not sure that they do that quite so well, or it does it quite so well, like, but it is, because it's just a hard thing, like, to estimate, but I think it can be still used, like, to get some kind of, like, ballpark things, like, because I think, like, what many are afraid, I think many are very, very much, like, afraid of, like, okay, so what if we have this carbon tax that would be enough, like, to stop the warming at 2 degrees, like, will I have money to pay rent and stuff like that? And I think, like, these are people have, like, compared to, like, what's the magnitude of the climate change problem as discussed here in the beginning, people might then, like, put these threats of carbon pricing, like, to, like, same magnitude, but I think, like, it's people are a little bit too afraid of this, and so I made this tool that where you can, like, you can choose, like, a climate target and, like, and then, like, set some, like, carbon prices there, and then it will kind of, like, and you can, like, set for yourself, like, some kind of, like, a path of, like, how your emissions are going to go, and then it kind of, like, tells, like, how your income is going to develop, and especially if you have this carbon dividend, so which means that, like, we get this carbon price revenue, carbon tax revenue, or ETS, it doesn't really matter, and then we divide that to all the people in the world. So and I think, like, what's kind of, like, very interesting here is that, like, many, like, we have discussed here also this, that should we have, like, a lower carbon price for, like, the poor regions, and then we discussed this alternative that this dividend or this kind of, like, a redistribution is the alternative to that, and I kind of like prefer it a lot because, like, if you have these different prices, then we have these carbon leakage problems, and is it going to be effective? Especially like you consider like these poor regions in Africa, for example, they are still like coming into this process of using a lot more energy than they are currently using, like this kind of industrialization process and stuff like that. So if they could skip the fossil fuel phase, that could be like very, very good. And but that kind of like requires that they also have like a very high carbon price. And so we could solve this by giving them this. If everyone gets the dividend, then these poor regions, because there's a very strong correlation between like carbon, how much emissions you produce and how rich you are, or how, what your like GDP levels. So that kind of like means that those who have the highest GDPs, they're gonna pay more carbon taxes on average. But if everyone like gets the same share of those, all of those taxes paid, given to them back, then those in the poorest regions and those who have generally have the lowest emissions, they would like be the net beneficiaries, like in monetary terms. So like some kind of like could be like so if you have like this kind of price that goes from $50 per ton to like $500 per ton in like 2080, so like one, this is like an example pathway that like people in the poorest countries, they would annually like get a net benefit like of like $300 or $400 per year. And that would bring a lot of people out of like absolute poverty in itself. So it would work as kind of like a global basic income in a sense. But these are of course like, but in, you can like make like various kind of adjustments. But if you have this, but like regardless of like how high the prices are and like how stringent is this climate target, the poorest are gonna be better off. And but there's of course going to be like some kind of, I think, like, because there already has been like some kind of like convergence of emissions, so like the emissions in richer areas are going to like come down, and emissions in the poorer areas are going to go up. But if they don't like totally like go like opposite direction, then like this is going to like remain this kind of system. But of course, and I think like one important like omission that this page doesn't have and that we haven't discussed too much is like this what we call in economics is the dead weight loss of taxation. So it means that because we are going to consume less of the stuff that like emits carbon, then we are going to have like less, we are going to be like less welfare or less utility. So I'm not going to drive my car as much as before and stuff like that. So this like site doesn't take this kind of stuff into account. It only takes into account like that stuff that is going to remain of like those emissions. But yeah, that's kind of like the short of it. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. You can continue.
There's an additional possibility for global redistribution as well. The one thing is to set the price level of carbon at different levels in different places, and there are limits to that because there's this leakage problem. But the other possibility is, and this is exactly one aspect of the proposals that I've been involved in, is to have a global fund where parts of the revenues are channeled, not entirely, because the states are still, the participating states are collecting the tax, so they keep part of the revenue. Yeah. And part of it will be channeled to a global fund. Now, there can be a major difference between the level or the ratio of that part that they keep, the states keep for themselves, and what they channel to the global fund. So the poorest countries in the world might give only like 20% of the revenues to a global fund, whereas the richest countries or those deemed the most responsible for the problem, they might be obliged to give as much as 80%. And that's a major difference. And then the global fund can be also used to mitigate the consequences in different, in those poorer parts of the world, like Africa, for instance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree that there might could be like well a good idea like instead of like redistributing all equally to have like some kind of like a share that is like kept nationally where it is collected, and maybe it would be like best to like somehow try to feel like what's the best, what's the like a good like what would be a good share, like what would be the system where we get like the greatest like political backing, like or the greatest support from all the countries in the world, like to get it to pass, because now we are in the phase that we have to get there, and how do we get there? We have to get the support. Yeah,
indeed. The if I may say an additional point about the gravity of the situation and why we need even further measures. I don't think even a global tax at the high level would be enough to counter all the consequences of global warming. The if we are really reaching like three Celsius degree warming by the 2060s, I mean that will be a major problem. And I've been starting to seriously consider the proposal that, for instance, one of my Cambridge colleagues has made, that there might not be any alternative to geoengineering. But this makes the global aspect of the problem even deeper, because geoengineering is highly unpredictable and its consequences are highly uncertain. And this might actually, if somebody decides to say, add, for instance, I mean, the reflection of the sunlight back to the space by the spreading some sort of aerosols in the atmosphere or something like that. I mean, the effects are perhaps the average effect can be anticipated, but not the exact location or the regional variations. And in some places, things might be actually much worse than before so on. So you really need to have a global cooperation on a scale and at the level that the world has never seen before for that to be possible. But to prepare the ground, I think something like a global greenhouse gas tax organization would be a very important and very promising step. Because we really need elements of unity on a global scale that the might seem totally unthinkable at the moment, given all the disintegrative tendencies in global political economy and world politics at the moment.
Okay. Janne, and then Juha.
Another problem, since we're moving into this mode of discussion, the seriousness of the issue, is sort of a concern. You know, let's assuming it's 3 or 4 degrees centigrade. Is my big concern is really a concern for democratic decision making systems, because what the 3 or 4 degree world means is it's some people call them creeping environmental crises, some people call them chronic environmental crises, others call it polycrisis. But anyways, it's an era of constant crisis in one form or another. Now, from history, we know that in all crises, decision-making systems tend toward authoritarian decision-making. If crises become chronic, decision-making systems, there's a danger that they become chronically authoritarian. So, and this, I think we should, this is sort of an overlooked fact and an overlooked concern that the context in which we make any of these decisions, be it trading systems, be it carbon taxes, will take place in a reality where we are recovering from a crisis, coping with an ongoing crisis, and preparing for a future crisis. And that's qualitatively different from what we have been used to.
Thank you, Jan. Juha?
I'm coming back to this geoengineering. Yes, I agree with you. We would most likely need geoengineering, but as you said, the consequences of that, they are, they, we don't know them. because it affects solar radiation, then it affects food production in different areas differently. Mm. It affects the rainfall.
Mm.
That's a very big, there is very big uncertainty. But even though we would need global net zero by 2050, that would not be the case. I don't say that. But I made a simple calculation how much emissions we will, or how much global emissions will accumulate before that. And that's about 200 gigatons. And if we just consider that just to reach net zero, global net zero, we would need 7 to 9 gigatons to take carbon out of atmosphere. And that's a similar amount like the current coal energy market, which is the biggest commodity market today, is. The size is somewhat equal. And after that, we should take more carbon from the atmosphere. And just think about what kind of incentives we should have that some company which have emitted from several during several decades, what kind of incentive we should have that they will give carbon more than just to be carbon neutral.
Okay, so let's now precisely focus more on the future for the last part of the discussion. And we have already touched upon this question, but let's now revisit it in more detail. So could a global carbon tax function as a means of addressing the inequalities when it comes to the effects of climate change, as suggested by some Global South countries who have called for a global carbon tax to help fund climate adaptation projects? Who would like to start?
I would like to continue this point that Janne raised and the about democracy and authoritarianism, because it's also related to this question of equality as well. I mean, what you're basically arguing, Janne, I think, is for global democracy. That the if we establish these kinds of systems, I mean, they have to be democratic. I mean, the legitimation has to be based on democratic processes one way or the other.
Yeah.
And the and that's indeed the idea about the Global Greenhouse Gas Tax Organization as well, that it is democratically organized. Democracy is a concept that can mean different things in different contexts. It's not only a one thing or one model or anything like that. It's more like a process and certain criteria or ideals that we have about how citizens should be able to have a say in political processes and many other things that are related to it. So in a case of a global greenhouse gas tax organization, I think we can easily combine three different principles of democracy. One is interstate democracy. Mm-hmm. So you have like the Council of Ministers in the European Union, where you have all the governments, they have a seat, but they have different votes depending on the size of the country. Because the Council of Ministers works slightly differently, but anyway, I mean, that's the basic idea, that the weighing is done in terms of the population of different countries, but only certain categories, like from 1 to 3 or 1 to 5 or something like that. So even the smaller states have a relatively big say on these things. The second is more direct democracy. I mean, the parliaments of different national parliaments, they could be represented in this body. And then global civil society, so participatory aspect as well, and they would have a real say in the more democratic part of the body. So that's one way of doing it. I mean, of course, we can also think in terms of representative democracy as well, that the direct elections and so on. But I don't think that a functional organization like a tax organization in a particular sector is very good for that purpose. However, particularly when we go to these deep waters of geoengineering and stuff like that, I think we need more legitimate the bodies in the world to have discussions about such matters and make a legitimate decision. And I think that's exactly the function of a world parliament. And the, there's a campaign, has been a campaign for the past 20 years for a United Nations Parliamentary Assembly. But the vision, in most visions, I mean, that's a very modest proposal. Mm-hmm. And then there are these world federalists who think that we need a kind of a sovereign legislative body of world parliament. I don't think that's a particularly good idea either. I mean, federations, they tend to disintegrate, and there are so many civil wars in the world and so on. So that's not a good idea either. But the world parliament could have particular functions and powers that are related to things, for instance, when we are talking about the or on behalf of the planet as a whole. Mm. I mean, vis-a-vis other life forms, but also vis-a-vis the planetary future, and the global warming is the most important of those. But there are other ecological crises that we are facing, extinction crisis and plastic pollution and many others as well. So that's not the only problem. Mm. But that kind of a body we would need. Obviously, there seems to be a slight discrepancy between what's actually going on in the world in the 2020s or at the moment and the requirements of these global problems that we are facing. Mm. And the real art of politics concerns precisely how to, in under the current circumstances, to develop ways of overcoming the currently prevailing disintegrative tendencies that are actually preventing us from taking any action against these global problems that are deepening very rapidly. Mm. I mean, just think about the Trump administration and their policy of denying even the legitimacy of using the word climate change. Mm.
Mm. Yes, please.
There's another. I'll take this from the global level governance to more regional and urban level, because that's where we've sort of done studies over the past decade or so on novel kinds of decision-making platforms. And the problem at the regional and urban levels in decision-making is really that the structures of administration and decision-making are sort of siloed into very traditional organizational structures that are in line with the assumption that things will go on as they have been going on for the past decades. Mm. Now, the challenge that these chronic crises pose is that they no longer are, the issues that we're facing no longer stay within those reasonably well-functioning under normal circumstances organizational structures. Mm. So we need something across those. Mm. And I think the problem here is that it becomes really complex, because on one hand, we still need the old stuff, the old administrations, because we still have all these duties towards the citizens. On the other hand, we have these overwhelming crises that keep coming that require cross-sectoral decision-making. And that's sort of the new challenge. I mean, it becomes more complex. It is not very streamlined or beautiful, but we do need integrative system where you integrate across administrative sectors, across experts and decision makers, engage the civic community. There's interesting work, empirical work on the actual social ecological crises that are taking place in Australia, in the United States, in many parts of the world, empirical research of what people are actually doing when the flood hits or when the storm hits. And there's lots to learn, because it's kind of this informal structure and informal process that emerges when the citizens have to do something to deal with the challenges.
There are theories that actually say about crises and critical junctures in politics that say that basically one sign of of a real crisis that generates something like a critical juncture when things can really change is when the sectors are not anymore intact, but they are, I mean, the one thing starts to spill over to other sectors and they're all in a kind of a dynamic situation. So the modern society is functionally differentiated, but all of a sudden, I mean, this differentiation is in a way cancelled.
Cancelled, yeah.
Any more comments on this question? Let's then turn to the final question and still continue on the topic of the future. So in your most optimistic vision, what combination of policies, institutions, technological innovations, and societal changes would together achieve a just and sustainable global future? A big question. Who would like to start?
Yeah, I can yes, take Ville. A stab. Yeah. yeah, especially like with this climate thing, like I think like I've been pleasantly and I think like what brings optimism to me that like there's been so much like progress, like so much technologies have gone cheaper, like solar, wind, and battery, and electronic vehicles, everything. And like it's gonna be, I think it's a lot cheaper to achieve like our climate goals than we thought some time ago. Of course, on the other hand, like some like estimates on how much warming there's gonna be, like per emitted carbon, some of those have gotten worse. But yeah, I still maybe want to like about this carbon pricing in general. I kind of like want to emphasize is that like maybe it's been said many times here already, but it's kind of like directs our emission reductions to those places where it is easiest to do, because the price signal kind of like between countries, between industries, between people, and for people like myself, like I can choose like if I reduce meat or if I reduce air travel. So it kind of like the price kind of like I can choose where I spend the money or where I save the money and kind of like make these choices. So kind of like that's why this like global carbon price or carbon price should be kind of like if we can just like get this message through that we have been discussing here like why it's good work so well. And kind of like before I was talking about this, that if you have this like a system of global carbon tax and dividend, it would be very good for like poor countries and their people. But I think it's also for like high emitting people. Like if we look at like what is like what would be like fair, like a fair thing would be that everyone has a right to equal emissions. But now like we in the rich countries, we are producing a lot more, and this is kind of like a way kind of like to kind of like instead of like me having like us having to go to so low all of a sudden, we can like kind of like compensate it. This system would mean that we are like compensating our being above average to the poor people, like and low emitting people, and I think it's kind of like it can be kind of like win-win, and as at least compared to like other options, in a sense.
Yes, Janne, please.
I don't know if it's an exact answer to this. I mean, first of all, say you asked about sort of the social design for a good future, and that my response to that would be what I just said about these integrative, novel types of integrative decision making systems that take into account the local circumstances. But there's a dilemma that we actually in our experiments with Finnish cities with high level decision makers and administrators and experts, we encountered this, that I guess you could call it, it's sort of a technological decision making dilemma. It has to do with infrastructure investments. In other words, the challenge at the local level often is if you want to counter these coming crises, be they storms or floods or droughts or heat waves, you have to do something with the infrastructure in which people live, and they should have a good life. And then the decision-making problem becomes this, that now you should invest heavily, make rapid investment decisions right now, because the implementation of those large-scale investments in urban infrastructure, for example, can take decades before they're in place. And by that time, we will be in that trouble that, all the climate scientists tell us. So then the issue, okay, huge investments immediately and a few good options. But then you go into, you know, how which option and how can we be sure that it's the right decision? So in a sense, you are in this dilemma where, for example, in the energy sector, a typical dilemma, which is sort of like an onion with different layers, there may be an investor who would be willing to invest in technologies utilizing clean, renewable energy. But they will only invest in that technology if there are assurances of green fuel existing. There may be investors who are willing to invest in green fuel production, provided there is that guy who is willing to invest in the green technologies, and provided there's assurances of the so-called hydrogen economy. There are some interests who are willing to invest in a hydrogen economy, provided there's assurances that there are other interests who are willing to invest in the production of the green fuel, and provided there are interests. There are assurances of global level, continental level, and national level energy policies toward massive electrification. In other words, the little investment decision in this green technology is dependent on the continental and national level electrification policies. So that makes it really difficult. The urban decision maker says that, no, it's really contingent upon the larger layers. Now, if these dilemmas lead into a paralysis in decision making, there's the highest level dilemma, which is this: that if you don't decide anything, you will be in that hell in the next 50 years because you decide not to invest anything. You are in that paralysis, and this is kind of the thing: how to get out of this. And my good world decision or proposal here is that we need bold decision makers. I mean, you will need to make decisions on that hydrogen economy, that electrification, and you will make wrong decisions. Some of them will turn out to be wrong in 10 years' time. But I mean, that's kind of the only option. There's no other way.
I'm a bit skeptical about the idea that we can solve these problems by technological means only. I mean, hydrogen is...
That was only one example.
Yeah, but hydrogen is mostly produced by dirty energy. I mean, the only very, very small part of it is produced in a clean way. And the applies to many other things. I mean, electrification, I mean, it has its own problems, and a lot of that is actually produced by fossil fuels and so on. I have a PhD student, Ruben Vetsoni, and he's going to defend his thesis in October. And his point is precisely, he went through some of these areas in a very detailed empirical manner and showed how difficult it is actually to rely only on technological means. I mean, the problems are still getting worse while there is a lot of investment in green transition done in a particular way. So all these points, in my view, toward the idea that we have approached or perhaps exceeded already the limits to growth, and these taxes also, they indicate that we would need to make some sacrifices. I mean, this is not something that we can only simply do and at the same time consume even more in the future. But on the other hand, I mean, if you look at the world economy as a whole, in many parts of the world, I mean, if there's to be any hope about the future, there has to be opportunities to develop. I mean, and this also means the better jobs and more secure environments and more things also to consume in terms of social and educational and other things as well. I mean, not only like private consumption, but some other things too, which actually requires some economic growth in those places. very clearly. But in order to have some kind of a balanced system on a global scale, we come back to this question of how to organize this globally. There has to be some sort of mechanism, some ways of organizing, including public investments on a global scale, which requires resources and so on. So we come back to this issue that to have a kind of a reasonable future, including for those people who are now really poor and many very often feel hopeless, but to provide actually hope for a better future. There has to be mechanisms that are not only about making sacrifices, but also providing opportunities. And these investments that are required can actually also provide opportunities for employment and development and all kinds of other things as well, if they are designed in the right way. The second point I want to make is that the technologies open all kinds of possibilities. I actually got an invitation to go to Tokyo, which would have prevented me from participating in this meeting. But I mean, luckily we have this technology that we can make a presentation or give a talk remotely. Mm. So I'm going to wake up tomorrow morning at 5 a.m. and I give a talk to Tokyo in a conference in Tokyo to avoid flying to Tokyo only for the sake of one session, like 2 or 3 hours, and then return to Europe. I mean, 30 hours of flying and stuff like that. But even though that's possible for individuals, and some individuals can seize the opportunity, globally, that doesn't seem to be working that way. There was a huge reduction in passenger flights after or during the COVID crisis. I mean, by 60%, even 70% or something like that. Mm-hmm. But the development, I mean, the previous 2009 levels were assumed by 23, I think, or 24, and now we're already exceeding it. So the 25, I mean, there are more passenger flights than ever before in the world. Mm-hmm. So with economic growth and with increasing tourism and the increasing international world trade. I mean, despite all these things that we've seen, trade wars and stuff like that, I mean, world trade is still increasing. Mm-hmm. And tourism is increasing. Mm-hmm. And when people become more affluent, they want to take more flights and mm-hmm. so on. So we need collective measures, and again, on a global scale. And this is the only way. So technological solutions are not enough. Individual morality is not enough. We need collective political solutions and on a global scale.
Mm-hmm. Mm. You are pleased. Yes,
I agree with you. To transform our emission or the systems which cause emissions, energy industry, I think there to increase demand, it's a very important as well. Until now, we have focused more on the supply side, and that is of course important to improve the competitiveness of different low carbon solutions. But even though they might be more expensive than those fossil based solutions, so if there is no a clear vision or clear view of increasing demand, there will no investments for low carbon technologies. That is, I think, important if you if you think about the combination of policies. Mm. And then, of course, all this what has been said is important. But demand is an important, very important driver.
Yeah, and I think we come back to this, like if you have this, like you have this tax schedule of like increasing carbon tax, then you have like those companies, they will know what the future will be like in terms of like what kind of energy will not be wanted. So it they know that, okay, this is the future.
Just one more example. You referred to hydrogen and you said that, yeah, most of the hydrogen is fossil based. And when considering the demand, we should increase the demand for clean hydrogen. That is the way.
Yeah, well, there are interesting possibilities. And 10 years ago, I wrote a book on the future of Finnish economic policy. Mm. And I actually suggested that to use the, for instance, tidal energy or something like that to produce hydrogen, and that would be a very clean way of doing it, and a huge possibility. A kind of a, if you now invest in 15 up to 30 years' time, you might have the production capabilities for that kind of a production. And and I think that's actually happening. The Finns didn't take the seize the opportunity then, but the but that's happening.
But when considering the future and the coming decades, future will be in a key role. And what is encouraging for me is the development of coast level of renewable power production. Solar power production, wind power production. I remember when the it was 2010 or 2011 when the Fukushima nuclear accident.
It was 2011.
Okay, 2011. After that, German decided to shut down the nuclear. A nuclear capacity, and instead of that, increase solar and wind power, and of course also natural gas. But this decision led into a situation where the demand for solar and wind power increased rapidly, and it lead into lowering or increasing production series of these technologies. And the companies, they learned how to make this in a clever way to reduce costs, and the cost level started to decrease. And currently, the solar power and wind power are the lowest or has the lowest cost of electricity production. And this clean energy, solar and wind power, is a very important source for hydrogen, clean hydrogen production. Without that, production of clean hydrogen would not be possible. And with that, we can further decarbonize aviation, road transport, and so on, with synthetic fuels and
shipping,
etc.
Okay, well, before we move on to audience questions, then I had one question that came to mind. Today in the news, they were discussing the ozone layer, and I was thinking about that as, is it an example of international cooperation being able to solve a very big global environmental crisis, the hole in the ozone layer and the agreements that followed? Could that be somehow, if you consider that as a example of a big major crisis that the globe
is. They were discussing what?
The ozone layer, the hole in the ozone layer.
Right.
I'm too young for this.
The Montreal Protocol of 1989 is the biggest achievement ever in global environmental regulations so far. It has been a huge success. I mean, without that, we wouldn't be walking in the sun anymore. I mean, the ozone layer would have been destroyed. They'd be able to stabilize the situation. At the moment, we see the an increase in the ozone the layer. I mean, the more ozone in the atmosphere, and the we are going to return to the levels of the late 1960s, early 1970s that we are considered to be the normal level by 2060s or so. So that has been a huge success.
It's also an example, the Montreal Protocol, of sort of the importance of having businesses involved in this, because what happened was that DuPont, which was one of the largest producers of the ozone-destroying chemicals, knew early enough of the coming of this international agreement, which meant that DuPont could develop viable alternatives. And had a ready market. So in a sense, this was an incentive for DuPont as a corporation to act to advance the Montreal Protocol, because it was they could cut out their competitors in the market. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, there's a sad story to this, that then the replacements were not so good for the ozone destroying chemicals. They were their greenhouse gas things and and all that. But that's old environmental history. I mean, it always goes like that. Some of the solutions. I like to use the example of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, where she talks about pesticides and talks in favor of natural alternatives for pesticides, one of them being, according to her, nicotine derived from the tobacco plant. Now, currently we know that neonicotinoids, which are synthetically produced nicotine products, are one of the worst causes for bees getting completely distracted and not functioning properly. So, but I mean, environmental history is full of these tragedies. We're always experimenting and always making mistakes and hopefully learning.
Thank you. So, but some type of Montreal Protocol, but for a global carbon tax, could perhaps be in the future. Okay, we now have some time for some audience questions, if anyone has a question they would like to ask. And okay, thank you.
Hello, my name is Alessandro. I'm here as a photographer today, but it's, the topic has been really interesting in our discussions that are always in my mind. Thank you very much for opening so many doors and new fears as well. My thoughts goes towards this question, let's say, because we're trying to find out through, like, for example, imagining a global carbon tax, some ways to somehow repair a hole that we have created, and we try to repair this hole in a form that the structure within which we play this, the world works, can keep its form, and we can continue that way. And it's the structure that I have in mind that I'm talking about is mostly this economical structure that is a capitalistic system that is a continuous growth that, to my understanding, from my perspective, is one of the biggest issues that we have in facing any kind of change, because any kind of direction that we have to take to somehow try to make things better has always to keep in consideration the fact that it's implemented within an economical system that foresee a growth as a form of incentive. So is there an option, this is my dream, where we can move within a system that is not only based on growth as an incentive, but is somehow can work in a sort of stability, in a sense. I mean, to me, I'm originally from Italy. When I moved here years ago, a thing that now is on every paper, but is like this contempt that the Finns have in their own culture that make them to be the happiest people in the world. It was like very interesting because it kind of put it, it could put a limit to what you can have, in a sense of what makes you happy. Now, in an Italian culture, you can work forever. You can take second shift, third shift, just to make a little bit more money. To me, it was just like, okay, a Finn at some point says, no, this is not worth the money that I can have is not worth my free time, for example. So is this kind of vision somehow, there is the possibility to export it on a global level to tackle issues in a different perspective and give even different incentives?
The first part of your question really concerns the future of economic growth and the economic system and so on. Some economists, particularly the post-Keynesians and nowadays, trying to think about what happens when the economy is actually declining and what kind of a macroeconomic policy can you have, and whether you can also ensure full employment and things like that, the good living conditions under those circumstances. The economy might be declining because the population is declining. This is happening already in many places, Japan being a particularly good striking example, but also because the there is no space for growth anymore in the same way. And the usual conclusion seems to be that the question whether this means a radical transformation of the economic system into something else is an open one, but it seems that that sort of an economy requires much more planning than what we currently have. So I think, seems like a very plausible conclusion. There are all kinds of possibilities for transformations, and it's not only a matter of some sort of a necessity dictating that we need to go this or that direction, it's also a matter of politics as well. But I mean, the general conclusion, the thrust of the argument is that we need more planning in the future. And the regarding this other side of the question, namely that whether we can be happy without consuming more or something like that. I don't know whether Finland is a very good example of that, but the truth is that we're already living in a stationary economy here since 2007. There has been absolutely no economic growth whatsoever. So that's one aspect. But and Finland is supposed to be a very happy country, but happiness is not actually, it's not a state of emotion or anything like that. It is combination of various indicators that are just put together and then calculated somehow, and this results in this assessment. The point is that there have been many happiness studies that actually also try to see whether people become happier in some kind of subjective or emotional sense if they have more money or can consume more. And it seems to me that, I mean, mainstream economics too has concluded that at a relatively low level, more money doesn't anymore mean more happiness.
One aspect of this is, you're sort of touching upon one of the current themes in environmental policy, which is kind of this discussion about degrowth, which is really an idea that you would sort of promote actively policies, including environmental policies, that would somehow start actively reducing economic growth, because economic growth historically is linked with environmental harms. I personally am I'm skeptical of doing it as an active policy, because I think it sort of shows a curious disrespect for the long-term evolution of capitalism, in which we are all tied. So we're sort of, if the climate system has long lead times and sort of this momentum that it just keeps going, like we like Heikki opened up, the same goes for capitalistic market economies. We're sort of tied in this big super tanker that keeps going. You don't stop it all of a sudden. So I guess it, for me, it's more of an evolutionary question that yes, I think we will encounter natural limits to our economic growth. I think actually global carbon tax is one of the intentional regulators of that growth in many ways. I think that's a way of linking this to the taxation issue. But I mean, over the long run, I mean, economic growth is, you know, it's a poor target of policy because it's such a messy indicator. I mean, if we're going to have any of this good future that we have discussed here earlier, economic growth in some sectors will inevitably result the way it resulted in Germany's build-up of wind energy and solar energy and the way it happens in China at the moment. And so it's economic growth when you do good things, and it's when you do bad things. It's all, whatever you do, it's economic growth.
Did you have something, Ville?
Yeah, maybe I could continue with what Janne said about if you put the, if you have this global carbon tax or price, in any way, it's kind of like, it is kind of like decrease economic growth it's going to decrease it, but it's still like, we still might have like a positive growth, even though if it's kind of like stifled, even if it's lowered. And kind of like, and I also think like we have talked here about like this, that like we have to sell this idea of global carbon tax to the global population and all the countries and stuff like that. And I think it's a lot better approach that, okay, this might lower the growth a little bit, or it might even like turn it negative or stuff like that. To keep us alive, but rather than going to that direction that, okay, we are gonna like stop the growth now and hopefully that like I will reduce emissions. So we have to target in reducing the most define like what's harm and then like target that. And yeah, and I'm also like quite like optimistic about like us having like a lot of this stuff that is not so high GDP, but we still enjoy like and still product. I'm thinking about like Netflix and stuff. I pay like €9 a month, and it's quite a lot, and it's not a lot of GDP, but it's kind of, you can have a lot of like cheap stuff. We have public transport and stuff like that, so it doesn't have to be high GDP to be like
Okay. Any other questions? Well, thank you, everyone, so much for being here tonight. Thank you to all our panelists. Thank you to our guests, our photographer and volunteer. And as mentioned before, the discussion has been filmed and will be available on our YouTube channel soon. And our next event will be at the same place here in December. So we hope to see you all there as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.